We Unitarian Universalists have been involved in the civil rights movement and struggle for centuries, sometimes directly and sometimes indirectly. One of the great connections is Dr. King often talked about the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. This was his succinct summation of the more florid words of a very famous Unitarian minister, the Reverend Theodore Parker, who wrote in Justice and the Conscience in 1853, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eyes reach but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and the complete figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." Today we celebrate the birth and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who did believe that the arc of history bends towards justice. But it's important to understand that that belief, that faith, has two parts. One of them about what is possible, the faith that there can, if not be perfect justice, we can at least approach justice. And the other is by works, that we have a responsibility in seeing that the arc of history bends. There are faith and works in the vision of Dr. King. The belief in the possible, the faith in the improbable, and that nothing can really show that faith in the improbable of a freedom and a justice that you couldn't possibly see better than that black national anthem that talks about the way that we, in this case the black community, but blacks and whites and all, both oppressor and oppressed, are diminished by hatred and by prejudice, the distance that was yet to be, and still they were singing of a future that they could only see in their hearts and with their faith. It was not before them. The mountaintop upon which they stood was a mountaintop of hope. But they did not wait for the arc of history to bend itself. They did not wait for God to do the work. They prayed, Dr. King prayed, people of all faiths who worked in civil rights prayed not for the job to get done by someone else, but for the strength to engage in the making of history, in the shaping of justice, the strength to overcome our moments of cynicism and despair, the strength to overcome the failure of vision and the weakness of heart that becomes discouraged when justice eludes us, when that promised land which we somehow think of as a destination seems to recede as we try to proceed towards it. They prayed for strength. They prayed for courage. And so do we. We know that when we study ancient history, that beginnings and endings sometimes get confusing. And so today we might be apt to celebrate an achievement that we haven't quite achieved. We have come a great distance, but it's important to place things in historical conquest. If the black church in America understood two things from Western religion that was imposed on many of them, it is the Exodus and Good Friday. They understood what it was to be crucified, what it was to be nailed to a tree or hung from a tree, to be flayed, to be spat upon, to be rejected. They understood what it was to be in slavery and to long for freedom. And they also understood, as we must understand, that when the Hebrews came out of Egypt and went to the promised land, that was, as you must realize, not the end of the story, but the beginning of another story. When Jesus lived and died, when Christianity was adopted by Constantine, it was not the end of a story, but the beginning of a story. When Islam was born, really with the retaking of Mecca, or if you want to move some years ahead to Constantinople, that again is a beginning and not an ending. We have come a very great distance towards justice, towards a promised land where we will see each other by the content of our character and not the content of melanin in our skins, but we are not there. In modern times, America did not become America at one distinct moment. The Pilgrim's Progress was a snapshot, a moment of arrival. But we built a country over a long period of time. Slavery did not end with abolition. And the abolition didn't even make it to Texas, arguably, till 1865 on June 19th, or arguably sometime next year. I'm sorry for the zets about Texas, Barbara. We did not end segregation when we ended de jure, legal segregation. We did not end racism. We did not end it even with Dr. King as the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. We did not end our racism in this country with the election of Barack Obama. These are all steps, and they are important, should be acknowledged, should be treasured. But we don't rest on laurels, because we as human beings don't deserve to rest on our laurels. The promised land is never achieved. It is built. It is rebuilt. It is repaired. It calls upon us to participate in its creation. Racism, ugly racism, still exists in this country in many forms. In our contemporary politics, you can see it, I'm afraid, quite clearly. Now, I want to be clear about this. I am not saying the criticism of President Obama is by itself racism any more than criticism of Israeli policies are anti-Semitic. But there are ways that one criticizes that do not go to the policy or to the character, but that go to that issue of race. There is in our politics something called the dog whistle, where you say something that is plausibly deniable as being racist, but it calls out. So that when, and I'm going to name names, Newt Gingrich calls Obama the food stamp president, it's code. It's saying black, welfare, dependent, and notice he's black. And he, when Mitt Romney says of Barack Obama, he doesn't understand America. He's not saying, I don't like this policy. He's saying, he does not, what does that mean? I mean, graduate of a pretty good university, Harvard Law School, professor of constitutional law, he doesn't understand America. He takes inspiration from Europe, which is really a strange criticism for such a Eurocentric nation. But this is code. He doesn't understand America because the implication is he's not a real American, meaning he's not a white American. It's still there. It's not screaming the N-word at each other. It's not the same rudeness as before, but we speak code and we have attitudes and people have racist prejudices and we have sexist prejudices and homophobic prejudices and class prejudices, where we look at a person and see a group and make assumptions. Now, strangely enough, I am not going to condemn all of the racists in the room or in the world, because I'm one of them. I'm not going to condemn all the people who have phobias, who shrink from the other instinctively or perhaps in a learned manner, because I'm one of them. It is an act of will and of conscience to get past our training, to get past our experience. I work really hard at not being a racist, homophobe, sexist pig. I work hard at it. I'm proud of the progress that I've made. But I am still, as everyone else also, an imperfect vessel. I was reminded of this only a week ago when I was flying back from Mexico. And as I was walking down the flyway to get on the plane, there were two planes, one on the left, one on the right, and I was walking behind two pilots, one male and one female. And I stopped and said, am I going to have a woman pilot on this plane? And then I said, John, what are you saying? But I had to acknowledge that impulse, because if I live in denial, I can't deal with it. I won't deal with it. In the 60s, a lot of my black friends would encourage us to deal with our racism, to look inside and confess that we had racist impulses. And the phrase that I heard most from white people was, I don't have a racist bone in my body. And I probably said that also. I resented that kind of Maoist self-criticism and didn't think it was helpful. But as I get older and I actually examine my life and my impulses with some emotional and intellectual honesty, I understand that I learned a lot of bad stuff from society growing up. I learned that, I don't know, it took a while. It took an act of will. How can I put this genteelly? My first encounter of a female doctor and a rubber glove was a consciousness-raising experience, as well as anxiety-raising experience. But once I looked at it, I had a choice. I had power. I could say, you know, this is okay. When I looked at the pilot, I could say, you know, okay, I understand my impulse here because it's a big plane, and how could a little woman be strong enough to fly a big plane? I went, okay, John, deal with it, deal with it. I was raised with the prejudice of low expectations, assuming people from different colors and different backgrounds had limited abilities because our society, which is a meritocracy, of course, didn't reflect the full use of the talents of people of all different races, ethnicities, and religions. I was brought up in a world that worked assiduously to narrow my vision. And I have to work just as assiduously to broaden my vision, to open my heart, to understand that the other is a source of wisdom and of nourishment and of inspiration and my fellow human being. But it is an act of conscious introspection and will, where we look at who we are, how far we have come, who we are to each other, and grow our own humanity by seeing the humanity in the other. I can tell you, as a young man, I was trained very constantly to be a homophobe. The world worked on me both to be afraid of male homosexuals — I'm old enough that the word gay wasn't prevalent then — and of female homosexuals, because they're not like us, which of course means that there's something in me that I'm afraid of that is like me. But it took not a single act, it took a lifetime to work through the prejudices, to work through the bad learning, to work through the limitations and the fears, and to see humanity in everyone. I still have prejudices that I'm working on. I will confess to you that it's very difficult for me to hear wisdom in a southern accent. That's prejudice. It is. It absolutely is. It's also prejudice. I remember a renowned philosopher from New York who was talking about philosophy, and he was talking in an accent that sounded ignorant. We judge, we profile by race, by religion, by affectional orientation. We judge by all kinds of things, and you know, some of it is really nice. Some of it you say, look, I am what I am and I'm proud of it. You are what you are and should be proud of it. But it takes a step to build a bridge to the promised land where we acknowledge our differences and feel enriched by them instead of threatened by them. The old liberal thing that I remember when I was teaching at Star King, I had an office downstairs, and Reverend George Johnson, who was black, probably still is, used to just talk about how he loved white liberals who said, oh, you're black, I'm colorblind, I didn't notice. That's not the dream of Dr. King as I understand it. We notice each other, and it's a good thing that there is biodiversity, that there is intellectual diversity, that there is affectional diversity, that we have different ideas and tastes. And if we lead morally examined lives, we can make progress towards a promised land. I used the metaphor of building because it is like building more than it is like arriving. We're always working on it. Where it's like having a house or a bridge. You start at one end and then you go back and you start again because it takes maintenance. The gains of the Enlightenment get threatened. The gains of civil rights get threatened. As John F. Kennedy said, they have to be won anew in every generation. So when we come together to celebrate the life, the sacrifice, the legacy of Dr. King, it's a legacy of hope that calls on us to do a journey inside ourselves to examine our values, our prejudices, and our proclivities, and to make choices about how to build, how to repair, how to heal. It is ongoing, and we are never finished. We are never finished dreaming, and we are never finished making the dream come true. And we are never too great, as I said in opening words, or too small to do it, to be a part of it. There was no way to predict that a little shepherd named David would be the great psalmist and first great king in Jewish history. There was no way to predict that an obscure carpenter at the edge of the Roman Empire would give birth to Christianity as it swept across the world. There was no reason to predict that an unlettered camel caravan participant, Muhammad, would his life and his insights would lead to where they led. There was no way to predict that a child born to royalty in India would abandon the materialism and of his royal status and become a mendicant monk that wandered the world, and that is Siddhartha Buddha. There's no way to have predicted that Dr. King would do what he did, that his legacy would be what it is. There was no way to predict that Rosa Parks, simply by sitting down, would bring down the evil edifice of de jure segregation. She didn't stand a snowball's chance in hell. Snowballs have a chance in hell when simple people do the right thing and live lives of examined values and do not live our lives according to the limitations of our vision or the parimutuel odds that society gives us. Look in, look out, reach out with heart and with head united to make the difference that you can make, that we can make in this world. Dr. King's life and legacy is the living embodiment of that vision, of that hope, of the fruits of labor, of love.